Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it or downloading it or putting it on an iPad, iPod, Surface, any type of device. Today we have a real interesting show because this is the first two-part show in the history of ESI Bytes. Frankly, we're having such a good time discussing the challenges faced by companies from the overcollection of ESI last month that we ran out of time and decided to continue the dialogue in a follow-up show. However, I strongly suggest for the listeners that you might want to listen to part one, recorded in January, because we can't revisit all of the discussions we discussed on that show, where we went through in a little bit more detail the contents of the Microsoft letter, which was presented to the advisory committee back in September of 2011, and as part of the attempt to understand whether the federal rules in e-discovery require amending. Suffice it to say, the amount of data being collected and preserved in active and potentially pending litigation, according to this letter and their self-audit analysis, is really eye-opening. But the problem with over-collecting is this is really like an iceberg, because the problem is much larger if you look under the water than just at the surface of what's happening in actual litigation. And that's what really popped out to me from the Microsoft analysis. The second thing is, we're not going to go through the status of the proposed new federal rules, because we addressed that in the first show. So what today's show is about the burden of poorly thought out or overly broad collections will place on search and retrieval, and possible ways that deal with over-collection and out-of-control data storage. You know, basically, can common law and common sense raised by today's litigants help to get us out of this problem? And this is something I've been thinking about for a while, talking about, blogging about. We'll probably try to write something for the DESI 5 conference in Rome later this summer, of the impact on search of overcollection, because I don't think a lot of people in the country have really been focusing on this. So we'll see what happens from the discussion, but the panel is outstanding, so it should be a memorable show. The guests are as follows: Judge Paul Grimm, who was recently appointed as a district court judge for the United States District Court for the District of Maryland, and prior to this had served as a magistrate judge since 1997. Additionally, Judge Grimm is an adjunct faculty member at the University of Maryland School of Law, where he teaches trial evidence, pretrial civil procedure, and scientific evidence. Judge Grimm's a frequent lecturer at CLE programs on issues regarding evidence and civil procedure, and has published several books and numerous articles on these topics. He's, of course, very well known for his thoughtful e-discovery opinions, such as Mancia versus Mayflower Textile Services on the Cooperation Proclamation, Victor Stanley versus Creative Pipe, and the need to explain why search terms are being created when privileged materials were disclosed to the other side, or Markel American Insurance Company, which deals with admissibility and authentication of ESI, Hobson versus Mayor of Baltimore on the complications of privilege waiver with a disclosure of privilege or work product ESI between different state jurisdictions, which now we have Rule 502 in place. He did take a little bit of a break from the e-discovery circuit in the past year while going through the confirmation process, but we're thrilled to have Judge Grimm back on his second ESI Bytes program since that. So we also have Judge Joy Flowers Conte, who's in the Federal District Court from the Western District of Pennsylvania, is one of the thought leaders behind the Special Master Program launched as a pilot program in the Western District of Pennsylvania a few years ago. She's been active working with me in Pittsburgh with our local Friends of eDiscovery group, which I help run, making it function as a model think tank where in-house lawyers, outside lawyers, and technologists can meet quarterly for informal breakfasts and discuss the sorts of eDiscovery issues which are seldom raised in court. One of the programs we did which helped to launch this topic was a spirited discussion on this Microsoft letter and the RAND study and how collections play out from real-life experiences of lawyers and companies in Pittsburgh. Judge Conte, like Judge Grimm, is well-known nationally on the e-discovery circuit and frequently speaks at national conferences. prior to her appointment, she was a shareholder with the Pittsburgh office of Buchanan Ingersoll, now Buchanan Ingersoll Rooney. And prior to joining Buchanan, she was a partner with Kirkpatrick Lockhart Johnson Hutchinson, now K&L Gates. Our third panelist is David Howard from Microsoft, who is one of the signers of the Microsoft letter, which forms some of the framework of today's show. This is one of the more fascinating documents I've ever read. I encourage everyone to read it. Just search for it online. Type in Dallas Collections, eDiscovery, and Microsoft. It will come up. David is the Corporate Vice President and Deputy General Counsel for Litigation. He joined Microsoft in 2010, is responsible for Microsoft's litigation on a worldwide basis. And prior to that, he was a litigation partner in the Philadelphia office of Deckert LLP, where he co-chaired the firm's White Collar and Securities Litigation Group. He's been repeatedly recognized as one of the leaders in this field by such legal ranking services as Chambers USA, Legal 500, Best Lawyers in America, and Benchmark Litigation, and was named a top gun in the corporate compliance area by Ethisphere magazine. Our last panelist, who's a new one for the show, is Tom Grix, who wasn't on the first show, but he's joining us here as a special guest. Because I noticed while preparing questions this weekend, it would be helpful to get the perspective of an outside litigator who successfully argued using technology like predictive coding in the absence of case law supporting his position. Tom worked with me in the Global Aerospace case, which is the first case where an order allowed the use of predictive coding was given over the objection of another party. Tom successfully argued for this order, and since the overcollection issue may bear some similarities to being allowed to using predictive coding when opposed, because any move to process less data in a case without an amendment to the federal rules is going to require a change in process based on new arguments citing open-ended standards like reasonableness and proportionality. I thought Tom would be great for the show because he's a trial lawyer and he also uses his chemical engineering background to make math-based arguments when they're necessary. So I asked Tom 2 days ago on very short notice to join us. He agreed to. He's the partner at the Pittsburgh office of Schneider Harrison, Siegel & Lewis, and he chairs their predictive coding practice, e-discovery practice, and litigation support department. And my name is Carl Schinneman. I'm going to inject some of my thoughts here like I did in the last show, because in addition to creating and hosting ESI Bytes, I've spent the last 4 years pushing for the use of more analytics, which evolved in the predictive coding. But with Tom on the show, hopefully I'll be doing more moderating. So we'll see what happens. But let's start the show with a brief disclaimer that the views presented in the show do not represent the views of the organizations which the speakers come from, but are their individual thoughts at this moment in time in e-discovery, which we all know is a constantly changing field. So let's start off this program. First, I'd like to ask Judge Conte and then Judge Grimm, if you ever hear specific arguments from litigants citing data they have compiled to make proportionality arguments. You know, the data I'm talking about here, we discussed in the last show, data points like on average, Microsoft has 45 custodians under legal hold for every case, and that 48 million pages they typically put under hold in an average case, they're only producing 114,000 pages or something like that from this total, and some of those other statistics.
This is Judge Conte. I think Microsoft is a head of the game, so to speak, in this type of situation. I have not heard any such data arguments. What I typically hear are references to the typical search using the search terms where a party will come back and say, oh, they have such a broad search. We've hit so thousands and thousands of documents. We can't possibly manage that within the value of the case that's before the court. And so that's typically the kind of argument I see. But even very large corporations in complex cases are not raising the issues that Microsoft has raised in its letter.
Interesting. And Judge Grimm, are you seeing the same things? Or
I think Judge Conte's experience is probably pretty consistent with what I have seen and what many other judges have seen. You get a not necessarily a representative view of what's going on within the whole country when you sit from the perspective of a judge who's got to resolve an issue, because by definition, everything you see is a problem that has come to you, and you never see the issues that get resolved without your need to become involved. And the lawyers who know how to approach this and to get the benefit of scale and economy and proportionality and phase discovery, if they get involved with a case with another lawyer who understands that, then you never see them because they work through these things. They take an iterative approach. They combine together to try and identify a common scheme or search methodology that they can both gain as they go forward by testing it to make sure that they get confidence in what's going on and then go forward. What we tend to get is either boilerplate, it's overbroad, burdensome, with no information to back it up at all, which is essentially a waiver of any objections because it's so poor, or alternatively, you get folks who have, like Judge Conte said, tried a search term keyword approach, which is not completely irrelevant, but is certainly not the most effective place and certainly not the end place of effective search. And they come out and they try that and it doesn't produce results that are manageable, and they then complain. And so I think that there's not a lot of there's not a lot of middle ground.
So and those types of focuses are focusing further downstream on the search, on what's in front of you. So and that's my reaction from talking to people around the country, and is that a lot of the times the damage has already been done by the time the collection is in place. Why don't we take just a little bit of a step back before we dive into maybe ways to address this, if litigants want to. David, during the last show, you did give us some helpful feedback that there's been no fallout at Microsoft from doing this data analysis you did, but that the analysis has instead resulted in more discussion on the scope of overcollecting of ESI and the problems this caused, which is what it was intended to do. A follow-up question to that, which I should have asked you then in the last show, is how difficult was it to compile this data? For companies that are thinking about attacking this problem, any advice on how they should do so?
Well, it wasn't very difficult for us at all. We made the decision several years ago to move from outsourcing all of our discovery processes to bringing a lot of the work in-house and then using vendors that were hired by Microsoft to do the review and some other functions. So when we did that, we set up certain databases and created some reports that would go along with those databases. And so all we need to do to get the kind of information that we're looking at, remember this is based on average Microsoft case, is take a look at what those reports say in terms of the amount of data that's been preserved, total amount of data that's been preserved, and divide it by the number of cases that we have to get the answer. Similarly, we can do the same with information that's been collected and processed. We know how much data we've supplied to contract lawyers to review. So we have that as well in-house. We find out from those contract lawyers, that vendor, how much data has been produced. So it was a relatively easy process for us to get to, where we got to. And obviously everybody's systems are different and everybody does things in a slightly different way. But for us, it wasn't that burdensome a task to get this information.
So, Judge Conte, one of the questions that I sort of framed at the beginning, and I've been openly talking at different events about, is, might it make more sense to propose looking where there's fire first instead of where there might be smoke, then iteratively maybe look outwardly for less obvious evidence if it's necessary to assess what's the most obvious information more quickly? Not the way people are typically doing it, but I'm just curious from the gut. Does that sound like that makes sense, or?
It does make sense, and I have seen it in a somewhat slightly different context, where you might have a case that say has is a nationwide class action. And the defendant will argue that this case is much about do about nothing, that the plaintiffs are not going to prevail, it's going to be so expensive, you know, because it's nationwide, and that the plaintiffs want to look under every rock. And so in those circumstances, I generally will pare down the discovery to, let's take it on a smaller scale. Let's look at where the plaintiffs think they might have the most yield in terms of evidence, and pick those parts of the country or segments of the business of the defendant, and then focus in on that, focus in on a few of the key custodians, and try to take a sample first. And then if that yields a significant result, then we can think about expanding it further, because then you might be able to cost justify it. So I think that kind of approach is probably a little bit, is somewhat similar to what you're suggesting. And I think it always makes sense to see if it's worthwhile to spend exorbitant amounts of money by first seeing whether there's really some valuable and useful documents that would be produced in the most sensitive areas first.
Carl, if I could just interject, I think that's terrific, and I think those types of attempts to narrow down the amount of information that's produced are really laudable. Of course, what that doesn't really address is the question of over-preservation, because that decision has to be made at the outset of the litigation based on what may be very vague claims in the complaint. And in a situation where, of course, the spoliation rules are not as clear as they could be. So I'm not quite sure, you know, how to deal with that issue through the type of filtering that you suggest. I don't think it really solves that particular problem.
No, it would not solve the preservation problem.
Well, Tom, you know, you're involved as outside counsel helping figure out the scope of discovery, and you also work with other litigators internally and externally. Do you sense that in general litigators are comfortable with technology and cooperation principles to try and intelligently push through arguments that, you know, we really don't need all this data through the discovery phases and not process it all? You know, if their clients gave them the types of data which Microsoft has now compiled, or is this really still very much nirvana with the fear of sanctions and spoliation out there?
You know, Carl, I think as a general matter, what we're seeing is the same type of issue that David is concerned with, and that is there's a huge preservation, and lawyers have such a tendency to ask for everything and expect that they're going to get everything, that we're really not quite there yet. But I think that what Judge Conte is talking about and that kind of an approach can be very helpful to the bar in attempting to move forward and deal with ESI issues. And I think one of the things that we need to start looking at is a way to be more innovative in our approach to discovery to deal with not only the massive amounts of information that are being produced, but preserved as well. I mean, some of the things that I've seen that can help move that along really relate to a phased approach that says, from the get-go, let me explain to you who my custodians are. We'll gather the data that we have from those custodians, and we'll give it to you. You can look at it and see if you think we've missed anybody, we've missed any non-custodial locations. And when we start to put restrictions, time restrictions, and enforce time restrictions on discovery, that will require the other side, both sides, frankly, to do an independent evaluation of the data, find out what's there and what's missing, and then move on to the next phase, we can actually, I think, set up a structure that will allow us to get to the end at some point in time and say, okay, we can take the hold off. The preservation hold no longer needs to be in place because the parties to this case have decided that discovery is going to be completed at this point in time, and any documents that would be destroyed in the ordinary course of business would not be subject to spoliation sanctions, absent negligence or gross negligence or something of that sort. And so I think we can start to develop those types of controls, and that would be helpful, but I don't think we're quite there yet.
Yeah, I mean, on the flip side, Judge Grimm, we do have some case law which puts lawyers on the defensive about not producing responsive ESI. I've done past shows on surveys that King and Spalding's put together on spoliation cases. You had a famous case, Victor Stanley. Last year, if we're dealing with collections, there's a case more on point, Pippins versus KPMG, where KPMG challenged their obligation to do a broad collection of many of their staff auditors who were allegedly not being paid overtime without getting more specific into their reasons, and then they were literally crushed by the court for not cooperating enough with the other side. So do you think that, you know, we've got these cases that maybe have bad facts in them that sometimes cause lawyers to become maybe less creative?
Well, cases that result in sanctions being imposed always create concern. And if there's not a uniform standard that applies across the board for parties that have a presence regionally or nationwide, then it's going to be a cause of some concern. And also for organizations and entities that find themselves involved in many, many pending cases at any one time. It is true that extreme facts may make law that has propositions in there that were required to address the extreme facts, but which then get urged by people on various sides of the dispute to apply to less difficult facts or less egregious facts. I seem to recall from the Pippin case that while it was true that a significant amount of sampling was required from a large number of folks, it started from the fact that, if I'm not mistaken, there was a refusal to even produce a couple of the laptops at issue for sampling and to determine what was in it. And that was the cooperation failure rather than some more amorphous criticism by the court. So I think that while it's a natural tendency for a lawyer, and I think that Tom's right, when you go to outside counsel or even inside counsel and the client says, hey, I mean, when can I get rid of this stuff? No lawyer is going to say, whenever you are hanging on to it. The problem that we have, and Judge Fasciola, who's spoken many times about this area, is it's an information governance issue. And the problem is, and I'd be interested in hearing from David and from Tom what their experience is in this regard, but it's like it's almost impossible for companies who want to control the volume that they maintain to police up the environment, because there's so much capacity and so much storage, and because if you have more than just a small number of people that you can verify what they're doing, is you tend to produce this information which is redundant and it keeps magnifying. And there's going to be a concern if you're an organization that has multiple presence in the region or the country that, okay, I've resolved it with this lawsuit. So if David and Tom are adversaries in the case, and they've worked through, and they've done the approach that Tom says makes sense, and they now decide, okay, we've gotten the data that we need. Now everything outside of these parameters that we've agreed upon, we no longer need to maintain. Then there may be regulatory compliance issues where they have to maintain them for a different reason. There may be agreements in orders to produce them. And there may be litigation that may be foreseeable that would deal with some of the same issues, even though not involving the same specific issues in this case, that if they get rid of it, then they are vulnerable for a judge saying, well, heck, you should have realized that that there were going to be more cases involving this, and you should have gotten rid of it. All of these make people reluctant. They make them concerned about what they do, and all that is understandable. What would be helpful is that we didn't get to this problem overnight, and it took a lot of different contributing factors to get to where it is. It's going to take some time and some multiple ways of trying to resolve it to the point where we get some improvement. One way is information governance is going to have to get hopefully creative in terms of effective strategies to try and not keep so much information for as long as it's kept. Secondly, if we get standardized rules that deal with this issue, then hopefully you get an across-the-board rule and it gives some more certainty. And then if you combine it with hopefully some certainty in terms of what sanctions might be foreseen and limit it to the kind of misconduct that is either willful or bad faith, and recognizes that a person who makes who behaves reasonably and what is reasonably proportional is protected against the kinds of sanctions that are viewed as being end of the world sanctions, then you're going to have an ability to be able to get a little bit of calmness, a little bit of predictability in terms of what the obligations are and the consequences and what you have to do to get in trouble. And then parties, I hope, will be able to relax and to then feel a little bit greater confidence by not keeping stuff forever and then just perpetuating the problem by having the volume continue to magnify.
Well, I guess part of the problem is until the data is actually loaded in and you can start doing some analytics, it's really hard to say with much comfort that this is garbage. So we have too much data that's out there to begin with. So if we're just looking at, you know, once it's loaded in, because you know we have the collection issue that I'm not sure how to deal with without rules, and you've got the data loaded in.
Loaded into what? A predictive coding database?
Yeah, more than likely some type of analytical tool, or it could be
got
predictive
it.
Coding, but more than likely some type of analytics that you know, looking at clustering timelines, things that you can tell a story about. you know, with those types of analytics, who would be the best person to be driving common law arguments? Is it corporations that are managing their process, like Microsoft? You know, like you just indicated at the beginning of the show, you've taken some steps, or is it outside lawyers that are looking at this space and saying we can make these arguments? Tom, why don't you jump in first? And Dave, if you have any comments.
You know, my answer to that is that, oddly enough, that's going to have to be a cooperative event. There's no way that argument can be made by an outside lawyer without, number one, the urging of in-house counsel, and number two, the data from in-house counsel that says this is the kind of stuff we're dealing with and why we shouldn't have to deal with it. But then number three, the ability for the outside counsel to grab that data, as you say, after it's loaded in and do that analysis. But I still think that has to be done not solely by outside counsel. It has to be done in conjunction with in-house counsel to try to understand what the data is truly telling you and how well you can recognize the data as being either relevant to the case or garbage. So I don't think it can be done by either one in isolation. I think it has to be done together by both, looking at the big picture of identifying what's there, what's relevant, and what the arguments are going to be for not maintaining it any further.
This is Judge Conte. I think one of the key points that most trial lawyers miss is during the Rule 16 scheduling conference, there is an opportunity to bring these issues up in what hopefully would be less of an adversarial situation. On the table, these are the issues with preservation. This is a very expensive proposition for the company. Let's identify what's preserved, what's not preserved, and ask the court to approve whatever the preservation plan would be for that particular case in light of the value that's involved in that particular litigation. In my experience, the lawyers are not taking advantage of that opportunity. For the most part, in every Rule 16 scheduling conference that I have held, there's a question raised about, are there any issues with respect to preservation? And the answer is no.
Right.
I think that's the time to bring up these kinds of over-collection problems, because it's early in the case, and the judge can put an imprimatur on the process that's used or the preservation plan, and that can relieve a lot of anxieties. But I think many, particularly defendants and in some situations plaintiffs, are reluctant to open the door on this issue, and so they're just saying, no, no, there's no problem.
That solves part of the problem, I think, if that happens, Judge. The initial decision about what to preserve and the initial process of preserving is going to have to take place significantly in advance of the Rule 16 conference. Because, you know, once you see the complaint or once you get the letter saying that you're going to get sued or that you ought to preserve, you know, the way the law currently stands, your obligation to preserve begins at that point. And that obviously is well in advance of the Rule 16 conference. One could see a situation where if you wait till the Rule 16 conference to talk about how much information you're going to preserve, and, you know, the other side can make the argument that, you know, you've already let the cat out of the bag by not preserving sufficient information, and perhaps some of it is no longer available. So I think in terms of figuring out at that particular point how much information needs to be preserved, there might be an opportunity there, but the preservation of electronic information actually begins much, much earlier in the process.
But at least at that stage, it would cut off the ongoing maintenance of that data that is not going to be beneficial in terms of having to be preserved. So at least you would know from that point on you no longer have to deal with that particular data.
I think that's exactly
that
right.
Way.
As long as, you know, we have litigants that are willing to be reasonable about that issue and judges that are willing to, you know, make a decision on those things at that point in the case. And that's not always, neither of which, unfortunately, is always true.
Yeah, and the reality is we can't solve all of e-discovery at one conference, but maybe we can take cracks at, you know, whittling down some of the problems. These arguments of focus, of intelligent focusing on where you think the case should be aiming at, really only make sense if you have an idea of where you should be looking at. And so let's try to narrow this down into, you know, typical type of case situations. You've collected the data, you have data, you're now meeting with the other side and talking to them. Do you at this point in time, Tom, typically know where you should be looking as the outside lawyer, and David, from the in-house perspective, do you usually have a sense where you probably look? I mean, I think you mentioned at one point that, you know, it might be easier to start have 10 custodians instead of the 45 that you have on litigation hold. So that's something's driving that.
My answer to that really goes back to something that Bennett Borden, whom you know, has talked about many, many times, and that is know your case from the outset. What Bennett has said, and I agree with him 100%, is I want to know what information I have that's going to be relevant to the case before the other side ever even asked me for it. And I want to know what my case is about and what the information is. So the answer to that is, yes, you should be fairly versed in that. As you know, we did a case where we did exactly that, where we looked and we said, these are the three custodians that really should have most of the relevant data. Let's see what it is we're seeing. And so we were able to work our way through that data, through those three custodians, and find out what, if anything, truly was going to show up by expanding the search to other custodians and grabbing all of their data, when in fact they were less likely to have responsive data than the first set that we selected. So I think you really should go at it early on, make sure you know that data ahead of time.
Yeah, we do an early case assessment in virtually all of our cases. So we go through that process excuse me, to try to identify what the case is about, you know, and who the people are who are likely to have the relevant information. So I completely agree with that. And obviously, we have a pretty good sense from our experience about, you know, what databases and, you know, where to go for information that's likely to exist and potentially needs to be produced. Although, you know, in every case, the most important thing is to have a conversation with the custodians about where that information might reside.
Okay, and then, you know, you can always have an argument with someone else, the opponent, about reducing the cesspool of ESI, but are there ways maybe for this to collaboratively be done? You know, how about carrots for the other side, maybe speeding the process up? And Tom, what do you think about offering to speed up the process in exchange for narrowing the focus?
Well, I think absolutely that's something that has to be done. I mean, I've been in a situation where I've drafted ESI case management orders, and my approach is always to do it as quickly as possible, try to identify the custodians ahead of time, get that data pulled out and produced to the other side, and give them a quick opportunity, some period of time, to take a look at the data and come back and say, we need more data from this person, someone who hasn't been included, or some other location, so that we can offer those types of things to the other side and work cooperatively toward the end, which is actually just getting this ESI into the discovery process and getting discovery underway and out of the way so we can move on to the case. So I think being able to offer the ability, number one, to do it more quickly, and number two, to give the other side an opportunity to weigh in on what they may see as omissions, let's say, in the production, is really one of the ways that we can move this process forward more quickly.
One, you know, there are some other issues of overcollections, and one in particular is the impact it has on search and retrieval. And one came up recently in a show I did a few weeks ago with Judge Facciola and Maura Grossman, and Professor Gordon Cormack was on the show. And Professor Cormack pointed out how poorly random sampling does in non-rich data sets as a predictive coding tool. And I know that Gordon is an advocate of accurate measuring to support more technology being used in electronic discovery. At the time, I thought I should have pressed him more because since it sounded like he was saying that sampling won't work with very large data collections. But my question is, you know, can we fault the tools like predictive coding and math tools like sampling if they become less accurate because we've mucked up the collections with so much junk? Or do we really have to do something on these collections? And Tom, since I know you and Gordon are such good friends, I figured I would throw this one to you.
Well, you know, you and I have actually presented together on this issue on occasion, and the simple answer is predictive coding is not a substitute for good collection, but conversely, a poor collection is not going to make it impossible to use these tools or to use statistics. It's likely that it's just going to become more difficult to make it work, because if you think about it, if you're looking at sets of 100 documents in a random sample and you're only seeing one document out of 100 that's relevant, it's going to take longer to develop the model of relevance that can then be used to do the predictive coding against the balance of the collection than it would if you were seeing 10 documents per 100. And as the richness gets lower because of the poorness of the collection, if you will, it becomes more and more difficult to implement, it's going to take more time, but it's certainly not going to make it completely ineffective. It will still work. It's just a question of how much time and effort is going to have to be put in to making that work.
And I also think you look back to how poorly things have worked before we've been using these tools. Every study, Blair Maron study, some of the Trek studies of manually trying to build keywords. What we're doing now isn't perfect, even with poor collections, but it's still vast improvement in speed and time and cost and finding more. We're still going to continue missing if the collections are overly broad with any search approach. So I just look for the improvement myself rather than saying it doesn't work very well.
Yep.
So, well, the back in 2010, Judge Grimm, you were on a show with Judge Facciola and also Maura Grossman, we just mentioned, and Chris Dale, and we were talking about the arguments that you could make when a party opposed using predictive coding and how do you bring this to the court. And the answer was to bring it to the court. What happens next? And since you answered this question so well in 2010, I figured I'd ask you about, the desire to maybe use analytical tools to show that and past history to show that we're overly broad right now. We want to be more narrow and work our way outward. Is there a way to bring that argument to the court or
I think
perilous?
We've come a long way since 2010. We have a number of things I think it's, if you go out into the blogosphere and you look at all the different organizations that have a reputation for providing a good, helpful CLE, and there are many of them out there, formal and less formal, like this particular podcast, it's hard to look at them without seeing some discussion about predictive coding or technology-assisted review. It comes up all the time. So the volume, the number of people who have heard about it is order of magnitude greater than it was before. Secondly, we have some cases. Judge Peck and his decision that he came out with, we've now had him, he's been affirmed. We have some, there was a technology-assisted review that was done in a state court case in Virginia. There was something that was discussed by a chancery court judge in Delaware. So that's, some courts have begun to dip the toe into the water. You are seeing the issue come up in presentations before the Rules Committee in the spring 2012 committee meeting for the full Civil Rules Committee. An appendix included a report that had been issued by the RAND Corporation, and all the participants in this conversation know what that is. It was 70 or 80 pages talking about, what are the sources of cost in this pretrial process, and it's sad, but we all have known for many years that the 70% of the cost was affiliated with review of information that had been identified as potentially relevant based upon the litigation and the discovery requests, and talked about the promise of what they referred to as predictive coding. You have advancements in Trek in terms of them using computer-assisted review of various types. You have programs like the Georgetown program in Washington last December where you had a panel talking about it, and search experts were talking about the strengths and the weaknesses, to include the point that Professor Carmack was raising. You've got the raw materials out there to be able to do a lot more than just say, we've got this Flash Gordon ray gun, Judge, that we can point to this data and take care of it all and just trust us. Not only that, but there's sort of a rueful expression that, so far we have small shoes to fill. Human review in terms of time and cost is how does computer-based search compare to the next best alternative? And if the next best alternative is not particularly good, then, you know, you can have a significant improvement, even though you can also criticize the offered solution as not being perfect, because perfect is the enemy of the good. So I think that we are much farther down the road of having the tools available for principled, intelligent parties and their lawyers who can convince the judge. I mean, when you come to Judge Conte or to me and you're trying to cooperate, you're trying to work together, you've got lawyers on both sides that are discussing the issues, they're working through it in an iterative fashion, they're trying this technology, they've given it some thought, you're almost always going to be much better off than if you come at it and you haven't spent some time thinking about it. So I think that we're much farther down the road in this area, and I think we're going to continue to see advancements as we come along in this year and the next year.
So, Judge Conte, does the lawyer and client that comes in the court and says that we've tried very intelligently to look at where the case was based, identify the custodians, we did some analytics showing us that we were finding very little likelihood of response of ESI, we've got a documented list of steps that we took to reach these conclusions, and then oops, later on, maybe a document comes out that they missed. Are those types of entrepreneurial lawyers and corporations running a high risk of being sanctioned if they find out that something slipped through that shouldn't have?
I think it's always best to have whatever plan of attack or plan for collection and review approved by the court. And I have seen this most recently coming up, particularly in complex litigation cases, where the plan about how the collection process is going to work, how the review is going to be done, how the quality assessment will be made, it's all laid out in proposed orders. And I find it very helpful to use the special masters who have special expertise in these types of technical issues that may likely come about to review the proposed plans and to assess whether they are appropriate. And when that comes to me for review, then I can sign off on it. So I think it's always helpful not to have hindsight problems coming in terms of whether or not the overall plan of approach was appropriate. Best to get that pre-approved and alleviate these worries, because hindsight is always a problem, because then you can see that there was some particular document that has a great significance and it wasn't found. And it's being human beings, we're always going to ask, how could that be? How could you not have found it? And that's where you get into where there had to be deletions, there had to be somebody actively working to hide this particular document, and then you get into expensive forensic assessments in order to see whether, in fact, that type of activity occurred.
So the one area that we've, I think, concluded is almost impossible to deal with right now is the over collection at the beginning. So let's talk about getting rid of data, which might at least help with some of that problem. What's stopping us from getting rid of data more quickly? And does some of this culprit lie of this mess lie at the hands of the litigants themselves for holding on to so much data? So do you have any thoughts on that, David, from an in-house perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously we could all do a better job of getting rid of data. But I think we also have to understand, you know, that it's a laudable goal, but it's really hard to pull off in practice. People are storing their records on their computers, on servers, as they used to store records in filing cabinets. And there are a lot more records to store than there used to be. And it's the nature of business in general that when you're done with something, you move on to the next thing, and you don't focus on, you know, cleaning up the stuff that you've been working on. Businesses, frankly, are in the business of developing products and services, research and development, selling things, and that seems to me from our from the perspective of our economy to be a pretty darn good thing. It's unlikely and impractical, I think, to expect that people are going to spend a whole heck of a lot of time in their work day rather than doing those things that earn the company money, cleaning up their files. So I think it's a laudable goal. I think everybody can do a better job of it, but I don't think it's a panacea by any stretch of the imagination.
Frankly, I've had administrators in small businesses I've owned I've gotten rid of that did too much cleanup and not enough focusing on growing. And I'm sort of thinking about a couple people right now. But anyway, well, let's look at an ESI bite, you know, a small problem, which is at the end of litigation. And Tom, I was going to refer to you in this question, but heck, you're on the show. Do you want to ask Judge Grimm the question?
No, because I know where this answer could go. You go right ahead, and then I'll reserve my comments until after I hear the judge.
Okay, so over a month ago, he wants a second crack at it. Tom told me he got into a discussion with another lawyer at Georgetown about his idea of running all the data through predictive coding, and at the conclusion of validating his results and giving the other side an opportunity to object to his results and the production, Tom then thought that he should be able to destroy the data he didn't produce because it's not an active business record, and it might get swept into another case, and the other side has had a chance to challenge the production and has accepted the production, and his discovery obligations are now discharged. So what do you think about that idea, which is sort of in contrast with my idea that I didn't discuss here of preserving broadly but then processing very narrowly, then iterally working outwardly, processing more. Tom's really saying dump it all in and then get rid of what you don't need to keep.
Is that directed towards me?
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's such a long question.
That's all right.
You write long opinions, Judge Grimm, so you should be able to handle a long question, right?
For sure. I don't have a problem with the length. I just wanted to make sure it was directed at me.
Okay.
The tools are all there. You have the very statement of the question says that you've got a cooperative approach to how you're going to deal with it. You've had some transparency involved so that the other side can verify that everything in there is there and that there's not some pool of information that's important to the litigation that's not in there. They've had some input into designing how you determine within that pool what you need and what you don't. They've had some verification that it's reliable and accurate to the degree that the demands of the case and what the case is worth require, and that they've gotten what they need. At that point, then, the ability to say everything else in this set that we have, assuming, of course, that that when you dumped it into the database, it doesn't exist someplace else. That's a big assumption. How do you know that you don't just have a whole bunch of information that you dumped into this system that continues to reside someplace else? But if you, at that point, make the decision that, okay, let's get rid of what has been defined in this case as not being necessary, then it certainly makes it easier for you to show that if you do that and document how you had taken these steps beforehand, that you've got, that you behaved reasonably and that it was proportional. Now, before you can do that, however, you can't exist with blinders on. So you have to make sure that there's not a regulatory or statutory or some other obligation to keep the information independent from this case. You've got to have done some investigation to make sure that this information, as you said, that might get swept into another case. Well, maybe it's going to get swept into another case because it's relevant to that other case, and therefore there's an independent obligation to maintain it. You have to worry about what happens on that litigation. If you lose the litigation and it goes up an appeal, and on appeal there is an order to go back and have a retrial, or to where you now need to go back to the information and you didn't keep it, is someone going to criticize me for having jumped the gun and gotten rid of it before the time to appeal has gone by? So you have some due diligence you got to do to make sure that this is a the best thing that you can suggest to your client that they do. But in principle, the concept has the makings of something that could be supported, but on an individualized case basis.
You happy with the answer, Tom? You want to?
I love that answer, and it actually is tied into something that I look at to help try to solve the problems that David is dealing with. And the truth is, in my cases, as long as collection, grabbing the data is not going to be exorbitant, and that sometimes is a big if. What I like to do is this: preserve the data, grab it, and require obviously preservation of necessary data going forward otherwise. But once you've grabbed that data and you've collected that data, you don't have to preserve it anymore in my book. We're done preserving data. It's preserved in my collection. All right, so that is one of the ways to start moving away from having to maintain litigation holds forever. That data then exists on the corporate system and can be dealt with in the context of typical document retention policies, where the data, and storage is cheap. 4.8 terabytes probably cost you, at least to store it, probably cost you about $500. You can then keep that data, that preservation data, on another media. It's sitting there for the litigation. So in that sense, if we can make collection a little more efficient and effective, we can start dealing with the problem not only of how to get rid of this stuff when we're done, but also how to lift the preservation holds that are tying the hands of corporations with so much data. David,
I was going to ask you a follow-up on that, David. I mean, Tom sort of thrown out that idea. Does that incrementally help the problem, or
you're talking about the idea of maintaining documents that have already been preserved for other litigations? I wasn't completely
well. It preserve, issue a preservation hold, then go collect the data for that case. Once that data has been collected, because it's not too expensive to at least store it at that point, the collection issue is a little different. But it's not too hard to store it. But once it's been collected, that data no longer has to be subject to a preservation hold because it's held on the collected media.
I think every company has a different way of dealing with those issues.
Right.
For instance, we actually have a product coming out, our next version of Office, that is going to allow us to preserve in place. Not have to create a separate set of media on which to preserve documents. So, that will be helpful. I think your idea, depending on the systems in place at the company, obviously makes some sense.
So, Judge Connie, moving further into the case, now the case is over, okay? And we discussed this at a Friends of eDiscovery meeting in December. Do you think it's permissible to delete litigation holds at the end of the case?
I think that depends on whether the case is on appeal or if a motion for reconsideration is filed. So I think there has to be at least a brief period of time, 30 days or so, to see if there's an appeal taken or if there is going to be some seeking of a reconsideration motion with the court. If there's any lingering doubt about this, I think it's helpful to go back to the court and say, we intend to delete this, to give notice to the other side so that if there's a problem, they can bring it to the court's attention or the court can actually address it and find out from the other side whether it's likely that this is going to be further needed, this type of data. Now, it would be also the case that if there is a likelihood of litigation from some other party that was not before the court, that would change the outcome.
So
last question here, and this is off topic, but it's the, you know, the sort of the end of the show here, and we've got a great panel here, so I'm just curious, going around the room from Judge Conte to Judge Grimm to David to Tom, what you see as your big issue right now here in mid-February of 2013?
That's a pretty broad question.
Yeah, well, I like to come up with great questions that help me come up with the best shows to be scheduling going out. So this is market research, but you know, it's also, you know, I mean, you get good people on the show. It's nice to hear what people are thinking. So, but you're third, David, so you don't have to. You've got a little bit of time to think here. I think I asked Judge Conte, Judge Grimm, then you, David, then Tom. So, Judge Conte, is there anything that you're thinking of standing out right now in particular?
Okay. I don't know why I always have to go first on this type of issue, but I can say that in most cases, the parties, I think, are so afraid of some of the costs or the issues that they are not bringing these matters to the court's attention. In the cases where they're brought to the court's attention, the problems are worked out amicably for the most part by the lawyers, and if they're not, I've had recently some resistance to using appropriate software even to do search terms, and I had to intervene using a special master, and then that was brought back to my attention. Issues on confidentiality, how is that going to be maintained, even with when software was going to be used, particularly if an outside vendor was brought in. But we were able ultimately to work through that, and I had to intervene and issue several orders to resolve the disputes among the parties. But that tends to be an aberration, and I think looking at what we've addressed here today, there's a lot of talk about the problems with over-collection, the expense involved, the expense of the preservation, but rarely does that really come to the court's attention. And so I've said all along that the best offense is a good defense, which would be to come to the court and get the court's approval of what's going on. But I'm still not seeing that happen. So I think until we start to see the parties coming to the court on the scope of collection issues, maybe seeking some new local rules, if we don't get national rules to help what David had assessed as the problem, that the collection of data has to start even before trial begins. How can parties have comfort in knowing whether they're over-collecting, under-collecting, that type of thing? So I think you need to get more aggressive with the use of the courts, seeking local rules, seeking intervention early as possible in a case to minimize the cost going on and going into the future. So I think that's what I'm seeing right now. I just really see a lack of the counsel being willing to bring these issues to the court.
Good. Judge Grimm?
Well, I think I share some of the same observations of Judge Conte. I think that the other thing to keep in mind is that however interesting this area is, and it is very interesting, and it's very important, we're still dealing, if you look at the bell-shaped curve, with a very small slice of the total number of cases in any one court before a judge. And the biggest challenge that I think that we face is that so many judges, when you talk to them, they say, well, I'm aware of these kinds of things, but they just don't come up very often with my cases, so I really haven't had a chance to get involved with this. I don't really need to worry about this until it actually comes up. And that it underscores the fact that we have to continue to focus on what I view as the three-legged stool. You have three components that are necessary to make these issues get resolved fairly and proportionately and quickly. One is that the litigants have to come into it the right way. They have to have given some thoughts as to their own obligations for managing their own data in this case and in all the cases, given what they know and what their business is. The lawyers have to come, and they have to be both technically proficient, but they also have to approach it in a way that makes sense, which is intelligent cooperation, and because it has a benefit that it gives to both parties to do so. And the courts have to be aware. They have to do what Judge Connie says, be available to come to when the parties have a problem that they need resolution. And they also have to encourage the lawyers to take these steps in a sequenced fashion that will allow them to focus on where the most likely source of information that's going to be most necessary to prove the cases or settle the case. And you have to keep focusing on all three of those parties, because if they are not all on the same plane, then imagine sitting on a three-legged stool where all three legs are different in length. It's a very shaky platform and a very uncomfortable place to sit. When they're all three the same length, then you have a stable platform and you could go forward from there.
Okay. Now it's your turn, David. Have anything to add?
No, I mean, I think I completely agree with everything that Judges Grimm and Conte just said. I mean, the one thing that I'll add is that I think a big challenge is a system that relies on the lawyers in a particular case to cooperate and collaborate well with each other, and one that leaves the ultimate decision about these issues up to individual judges, given the type of issues that we're dealing with. And so, you know, for us, obviously, one of the things that we've been working on over the course of the last couple of years is trying to advocate in favor of rule reform, and that's going to continue to be a focus.
Okay. Take some of the crapshoot out of the process. I understand that. And Tom?
What do I see as the big issue in 2013, I think, really is going to be the confluence of, frankly, everything we've talked about today. It's going to be bringing together advanced analytics with information governance and defensible deletion, so we can get to the point where corporations are not being bound by all of this data that has to be preserved. We can actually find a way to legitimately get rid of it. That may be through technology, it may be through rules, but bringing that all together to find a way to be able to limit the amount of data that has to consistently be retained on a routine basis for all these litigations. I think what we're going to see, a lot of the issues revolve around as we move forward.
Can I ask a question? This is Paul.
Sure.
David, here's my question to you and to Tom, because you both have a solid grounding in technology. One of the things that I worry about is, what's the next big technological breakthrough or technological development that's going to throw a new concept into the mix of what we're already dealing with to get everybody scratching their heads saying, this is something that we've never seen before. From the evidentiary point of view, I will tell you that I've been looking at evidentiary issues associated with this for a long time, and all of a sudden since 2010-11, there are suddenly just a ton of court cases struggling with and reaching contrary conclusions on similar facts regarding admissibility of social media evidence, because social media evidence now is no longer restricted to social media involvement for social reasons. It's big business. You look at every advertisement and every radio or TV show, and it's like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. So it has become part of the matrix of the fabric of how we do business. Cloud-based computing systems as opposed to owning your own servers. I mean, each one of these new technological steps and advances that goes forward makes the platform that much more difficult, because it adds to the existing technological issues, none of which are all completely integrated to have a perfectly predictable way of dealing with them. Do you see technology continuing to move at this pace that it has in the last 10 years? And so the minute we get, you know, sort of smug that we think that we're making progress, all of a sudden we get our feet knocked out from underneath us because there's some new technological way of dealing with all this, and all of a sudden none of the ground rules make any sense anymore.
You know, Judge, I'm a lawyer. I'm going to let the guy from Microsoft.
Yeah, a technology company.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that because I'm a lawyer too, and
right.
don't develop the product. But I do think that there are some challenges ahead, and I think, you know, I'll just name a couple of them. One you already named, Judge, and that's social media, because not only you know do you have social media now being used for, you know, purely personal purposes, but there are an array of social media tools now available and being encouraged to be used for businesses.
Yeah.
So and we own one of them. It's called Yammer.
And that changes the platform. I mean, it changes the way you do it. And
it changes the platform, and, you know, you can think about a situation, for instance, where, you know, employees from all over the company are talking about an issue that may end up being relevant in discovery. And, you know, getting your arms around that and figuring out how to find that information and preserve it is, you know, a new challenge that we're just beginning to start to face. The other thing that I would say is going to be a continuing development is something that we call the consumerization of IT,
right?
Which is that you're getting a convergence of people's personal technology and email and that sort of thing with business technology,
right?
And so I think one of the issues that we might expect to see in the future are more and more cases where the issue is, you know, how do you separate this person's personal life from their work life that may be properly subject to discovery.
Right.
So those are a couple of the challenges I think that are coming down the line.
So Carl, you got your next podcast?
Yeah, I've got a bunch of them and Friends of eDiscovery. We're doing Bring Your Own Device to Work at our next meeting in Pittsburgh. I sat in one on Cleveland. This is a set of shows and educational events that will never hit Answered, I think. So, but hey, I want to thank all of you guys, you know, Judge Connie, Judge Grimm, Tom, David, for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, even if we can't answer every question. But hopefully, we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can remember the show and website phonetically, as it sounds out as Easy Bytes of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes, learn more about eDiscovery before ESI Bytes you back. This is Carl Shinman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.
Thanks, everybody.